You are Locked On MLB, your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast where we talk about all of Major League Baseball, and I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. In today's episode, which is being dropped on the 15th day of April 2020, we'll be paying tribute to Jackie Robinson and take a look at two teams that were great in the 2000s that probably slipped through the cracks in your memory because they didn't win it all. This show is available on the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app. We're also available wherever you get your podcast. You can go directly to the website Locked On MLB, or when you're at home during this trying times, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, where it truly is your team every day, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball, hosted by Scott Cullen. Check us out on Twitter at LockedOnMLB_net. We're at Instagram at LockedOnMLB. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. Well, it is the 15th day of April, which in baseball terms has always been Jackie Robinson Day. It is the 73rd anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. And this is something worth celebrating. This is why players wore 42. All the players wore 42 starting on the first time they did this celebration. I believe it was 97 they did the celebration. No, that's when they retired 42 from all across baseball. And it's a great thing because he is worth celebrating. I mean, he was a wonderful player, a Hall of Famer as a player. Obviously, what he did in terms of breaking the color barrier was remarkable, but his legacy is more complicated and I think more heroic than what you would see in movies like The Jackie Robinson Story or 42, two films that were both very well intentioned, but I think kind of scratched the surface only of what Jackie Robinson did and the character of who he was. What people tend to focus upon are the years that he didn't fight back, and because we are a martyr-obsessed culture, that seems to be the part of his life and an aspect of his life that people seem to latch on to. That when Branch Rickey signed him, he said you couldn't fight back, that no matter what racial epithet they're going to throw at you, because he understood that if he was seen fighting back, the entire experiment would fail, no matter how unfair that is. And so that aspect of his life is always brought up ad nauseum, that he never fought back, he never fought back. Well, he did. That prohibition from him fighting back were only for the first two seasons of his career. It was only for 47 and 48. After 48, Branch Rickey said, go ahead, you can fight back now. And he did. He did big time. He fought back against the press. He fought back against umpires. He fought back against any perceived slight. He fought against his teammate, Roy Campanella, who he felt was not active enough in civil rights issues. He fought against sports writers. He fought against the baseball establishment. And he did so always with the mindset of, I'm trying to make the world better, and we need someone to fight. It's not always the martyr who wins. He wanted to be someone to roll up his sleeves and get things done. And that extended beyond baseball. When you look at, he became an executive at the Chock Full of Nuts Company, which was one of the biggest employers of African Americans in the 1950s. He quit baseball. He was traded to the Giants after the 56th season. Now, whether or not he didn't want to sign with the Giants after the trade, or he was thinking about quitting anyway, he didn't play for the Dodgers their final season in Brooklyn. 57, he had retired after the 56 World Series. His last hit, by the way, was a walk-off single in the bottom of, I believe, the 10th inning of Game 6 of the 1956 World Series. But I digress. He was focusing more on beyond making progress in athletics. Let's make progress in terms of economics, in terms of becoming self-sufficient, in terms of business. And that's what he did. He fought for political causes and, in fact, campaigned for Republicans because he didn't want to have the Democrats after the civil rights became the Democrats' platform. He wanted to make sure that it wasn't just one party looking after the interests of African Americans. Ultimately, he left the Republicans when he felt that Nixon was going bananas, but that's neither here nor there. He was a fighter right to the very end. His final public appearance was at the 1972 World Series when he was already dying, a relatively young man. And he gave a speech at the opening of the World Series in Cincinnati and took the time during the speech to make sure his displeasure was known that there were no African-American managers in Major League and no African-American general managers. And he died several days after that. He was a fighter, big time. He had his opinions known, big time. He not only feuded with his teammate Roy Campanella, he feuded with Malcolm X. He feuded with lots of people and fought and made sure his sleeves were rolled up and people knew how he felt. And the impact he had on the game, really, it's a hard time to measure it because you could think about it in terms of social justice. But as a fan, you also got to think about it as a baseball fan and how much better it made the game. Think about the players, the African-American players who came in shortly afterwards, whether it was Don Newcomb, whether it was Monty Irvin, whether it was people like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Frank Robinson, Ernie Banks, Fergie Jenkins, whether it was people like Bob Gibson, whether it was people like Reggie Jackson, whether it was people like Ozzie Smith, Ricky Henderson, Frank Thomas, Ken Griffey Jr., whether it was, you know, Bonds, whether it was Barry or Bobby Bonds. These are all people who would never have been able to play in the majors. Derek Jeter, forget it. Bernie Williams, where's your core four? Where's CeCe Sabathia? And that's not even to bring up the dark-skinned players from the Caribbean and from Central America. You wouldn't have Roberto Clemente. You wouldn't have Albert Pujols. You wouldn't have Mariano Rivera, Pedro Martinez, David Ortiz, Vladimir Guerrero, Rod Carew. You wouldn't have Juan Marichal. You wouldn't have Edgar Martinez. You wouldn't have Manny Ramirez. You wouldn't have Tony Perez or Luis Aparicio or Tony Oliva or Louis Tiant. You wouldn't have the family Alou or the family Molina. You wouldn't have any of these players. And that's because of the doors that were open with not just Jackie Robinson, but let's forget Larry Doby, who also came in 1947, who seems to be forgotten but faced many of the same travails that Jackie did. When you think about the players from the Negro Leagues, if you start praising them, there's almost a sense of you're trying to be politically correct, that you're including Josh Gibson in the conversation, or Cool Papa Bell, or Oscar Charleston, or Buck Leonard, or Turkey Stearns, that bringing Buck O'Neill as a great voice in terms of an ambassador of baseball, or Rube Foster being one of the brightest minds in baseball history, it makes you sound like, oh, you're being politically correct. But when you think about some of the players from that era, when you think about people who we still know and associate with certain teams, whether it's Ty Cobb, whether it's Rogers Hornsby, whether it's Babe Ruth, whether it's Bob Feller, whether it's Honus Wagner, who we still are honoring at various stadiums. Why wasn't Buck Leonard associated with one of those teams? Why wasn't he one of the great Phillies of all time? Why wasn't Cool Papa Bell on a team like the Cardinals or the Reds? Josh Gibson is this sort of phantom figure. How great was he? Why didn't we know? Why wasn't he player for the Boston Braves or the Washington Senators or wherever? And Satchel Paige, who became an all-star when he was Lord knows how old, why wasn't he an ace for a team like the Indians or the Cardinals or the Browns? Notice I'm not saying the Red Sox. There's no way they would have done it. The game of baseball is better because of integration. And something you need to think about. If I had a podcast back in 1947, if that existed, and I was preaching for integration, I guarantee you there would be a lot of people rubbing up against it saying, hey, stick to baseball. Quit being so politically correct and everything like that. There was an opposition. And the opposition was sticking to baseball, which is what people were saying to the Dodgers. Oh, I don't want to think about all this. Can we just play baseball? Yeah, let's play baseball and have it be better. So in this time where we are at home and not going out, as you shouldn't be, you may be wondering, hey, how am I going to eat? Where am I going to get my food from? And how do I support some of these local businesses? Well, one thing you could do is use Postmates. Now, if you're like me, you like to think about what you're going to eat for dinner while you're eating lunch. I love to eat, and I love using Postmates. They deliver food from all the restaurants that I want to keep supporting during this crisis. And they don't just deliver your food. They can make trips to the grocery store, convenience stores. It's a terrific, terrific service that I use all the time. So guess what? Download Postmates on iOS or Android. Find your favorites and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start free deliveries, download the app and use the code LOCKEDON. That's code LOCKEDON for $100 of free delivery credit with no minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. You know, I was thinking about, when I'm thinking about the best teams of the decade. We were talking about that a little bit last week when I was bringing up the best teams of the American League, the best team in the National League of the 2010s. I was thinking about the 2000s. And one thing that kind of hit me was sometimes when you think about the best teams, you automatically start to look at the team who won the World Series. I made that point when I was talking about the best teams of the 2010s. And several of the teams are clubs that didn't win the World Series. Hell, the Philadelphia Phillies of 2011 didn't even make it out of the Division Series. And when I'm thinking about the best teams of the 2000s, a lot of times the best team didn't win. And a lot of times the teams that become close to the heart of a fan base is not necessarily the best squad of that time. I'll give you two examples. The 2000 Yankees won the World Series. They beat the Mets. And there's an aura that that was the third straight team that won. They must have been a great Yankee team. They won 87 games. They had a horrific September. And they barely made it out of the Division Series against Oakland. The Mets actually won 7 more games than the Yankees did during the regular season. But that's a team that won the World Series and continued their great run of winning titles. But take a look at a team, if I said the 2002 Yankees, that would probably get a gigantic shrug from everyone, including the biggest Yankee fans out there. Like, which team is more beloved, the 2000 squad or 2002? It's not even an issue. But the 2002 squad, I would argue, was one of, if not the best Yankee squad of the decade. They won 103 games. They were on a mission after losing the World Series in the post-9/11 series against the Arizona Diamondbacks, where they were two outs away from winning it all. And then the great Arizona comeback, led by the Tony Womack double, which I think is the most underrated hit in baseball history. But I digress. The Yankees had a big-time facelift. Tino Martinez was gone. Scott Brosius and Paul O'Neill both retired, and Jason Giambi came over as a big, huge, honking free agent acquisition. And Giambi, who started off slowly, wound up having a great year. Lord knows what he was putting in his body, but everyone was putting weird stuff in their body. Giambi had an OPS of 1.03, hit 41 home runs, batted .314. No one seems to remember that. Alfonso Soriano was blossoming into the next great Yankee superstar. He was only 26 years old, hit 39 home runs, batted .300, and was going to be the next great Yankee. And he was going to play alongside Jeter, who had another tremendous season. Robin Ventura was inserted into third base to supplant Scott Brosius. He had a fine season. And a slight rotation of outfielders, whether it was Rondell White, or Shane Spencer or John Vanderwall played. Bernie Williams was still tremendous, had an OPS over 9, was still one of the best and I think most underappreciated Yankee of that time. Raul Mondesi did an okay job. Their rotation of Mussina, Wells, Clemens, El Duque Hernandez, Andy Pettit, they still had Mariano Rivera. Ramiro Mendoza was no longer a spot starter, was entrenched in the bullpen, had a fantastic year. And Steve Carce gave them depth, and they had acquired Jeff Weaver, who was going to be the next great young stud. And it looked like it was going to be the third straight year where the Yankees and A's were going to collide in the postseason. But this time they were going to collide in the ALCS because the A's couldn't lose, and the Yankees couldn't lose. And the Yankees wound up having one win better than the A's. So if there's going to be an ALCS matchup, that was it. Now, the previous two ALCS matches were tremendous five-game, or the division series matches were tremendous five-game series. They both went the Yankees' way. Well, now, this was the team that they followed in Moneyball. This was the Yankee team that was going to get revenge for the 9/11 World Series, and all they had to do was brush off their easy opponents in the division series and face off. And the fact of the matter is the Angels were in the division series. It was a franchise that had never won a playoff series ever. And the Twins were playing the A's, and the Twins were on the verge of being contracted. So they were basically there as almost as a courtesy for the razor-thin American League Central. But what happened? The Angels came from behind to win Game 2 in the division series against the Yankees, sent it tied back to Anaheim. They won in a weird Game 3, and then David Wells imploded, and the Yankees lost. The 103-win Yankees lost. Notice there was no A-Rod yet. There was no Hideki Matsui yet. This was going to be Soriano and Giambi's club to go alongside Jeter and Bernie and Posada and all of them. Nobody remembers that team. This was a tremendous ball club. Managed by Joe Torre, 103-58. That team's forgotten. The 87-win team is remembered for all time. Go figure. Another team that probably would have been considered one of the great teams of the decade and would have been the culmination of one of the great stories in baseball history was the 2006 Minnesota Twins. And you're saying, huh? Yeah, I'm saying them. This was a team that was chock full of stars. Now remember, after 2001, they were rumored to be contracted. But they went out, they won the division, got to the league championship series in 2002, made it back to the playoffs in 2003, 2004, missed in 2005 because the White Sox were unstoppable. And then this 2006 season, they were terrific, but they were fighting tooth and nail with a surprising Tigers club. And it looked like the Tigers were going to win the division, and the Twins were going to have to settle for a wild card spot. But the Minnesota Twins went on a rampage. They were down 5 games of the standings in early September, but then could not seem to lose. And they went on a 5-game winning streak, then a 4-game winning streak, then another 4-game winning streak. And then on the final day of the season, they defeated the defending World Series champion White Sox 5-1. The Tigers lost, and the Twins won the division. It was the only day they were in first place by themselves. They won the division and did so with a stacked ball club. Joe Mauer, who was 23 years old at the time, batted .347 with an OPS of .936. He was the premier catcher in baseball. Justin Morneau was the AL MVP when he had an OPS of .934 with 34 home runs. Torrey Hunter hit 31 home runs. Michael Dyer added 24 home runs of his own. And the team was led by Johan Santana, who arguably could have won the MVP himself. I don't much look at the win-loss record. He was 19-6. He threw 233 2/3 innings, struck out 245, only walked 47, was the dominant pitcher in baseball. He had company with Francisco Liriano, who was putting together a Cy Young caliber season before injuries derailed the season. And Joe Nathan was absolutely unstoppable as a closer. They had to play the A's, and the A's were a team that, you know what, the A's can't win in the postseason. They never won anything in the postseason. And so the Twins looked like a team that if they won the World Series, first of all, it would have been a Twins championship in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, but it would have been the culmination of a team that was on the verge of contraction, winning it all. And Ron Gardenhire, who would be the Twins manager for all those postseason appearances, would have an aura of being, hey, is this a Hall of Fame manager? He took a team that was going to be contracted and won the World Series. So what happened? Frank Thomas happened. I bet you forgot Frank Thomas was on the A's that year. Well, the A's certainly didn't forget that, and neither did the Twins. Thomas homered twice in Game 1, one of them off of Johan Santana, and Barry Zito outpitched Santana. And then the A's won Game 2, and then the Twins fell apart in Game 3, and a squad that won 96 games and looked like it was going to be the team to win it all couldn't win one playoff game. And it is obscured. When you think of the teams that won the World Series that in that decade, you saw the St. Louis Cardinals win the World Series in 2006. I would argue that was the single worst St. Louis team to make the playoffs that decade. The year before, in 2005, they had an outstanding ball club that looked like they were going to go and win the whole thing. In fact, when they played the Houston Astros, they wound up, the Cardinals looked like they were going to pull off a tremendous come from behind in the series because the 100-win Cardinal team fell behind 3-1. But Pujols hit the home run off of Lidge, which everybody remembers, and sent the series back to St. Louis with Mark Mulder on the mound. But what happened? The Astros won. That was a much better Cardinal team in 2005 than the 2006 squad. But the 2006 squad, who only won 83 games, won the World Series. And in the end, as basically as faulty a system as it is, that's how we judge our teams. So the 2002 Yankees, the 2006 Twins, and the 2005 Cardinals all fall to obscurity, even though demonstrably they were three of the best teams of that decade. So we salute Jackie Robinson. Remember three teams that may have slipped through the cracks because they didn't win all the games in October. So go to the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app and like us wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to follow Locked On Fantasy Baseball hosted by Scott Cullen. This has been the Locked On MLB show for the 15th day of April 2020. Happy Jackie Robinson Day. I'm yours, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.